Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is State of Laboratory Medicine and Histopathology in the United Kingdom. The presenter is David Ricketts, DR, Process Improvement Consultant, Sonic Healthcare UK, Essex, United Kingdom.
Thank you very much for coming along. I know it's not as sexy as the last talk, and it's quite interesting hearing about laboratory-developed tests and the ensuing panic that I felt. One of my jobs is I, as well as working for Sonic, I write international standards. So I'm one of the authors of ISO 15189, which covers pretty much everything that you need to do for the FDA. As well as that, you'll be delighted to know we're just about to launch ISO 5649, which is Medical Laboratories, Concepts and Specifications for the Design, Development, Implementation and the Use of LDTs. So in the next few months, there will be an LDT document which explains in detail validation, quality management, which will support. So there is documents out there to help you. But that's not actually why I'm here to talk. It just happens I listened to the last talk and thought, actually, I don't think it's that difficult. It takes work. It takes a lot of organisation. But there is lots of support there to help you. So, thank you to the Dark Report and the War College for inviting me over to speak to you. You can hear from my accent, I'm not from around here. So I come from Essex, and I always like to joke, I come from Essex, so English is not my first language. It's East London, South Essex, so I know it's an interesting accent. So if you're struggling to understand me, trust me, I will not be offended if you ask me to repeat anything or slow down. And I will try and talk in the Queen's English or my version of it. So, I've been asked to talk about pathology in the UK, and you think, well, what's that got to do with us? Well, actually, there's some very interesting things which I think really do apply to the American market, and there's some opportunities there that we have in the UK that I think will both boost profitability for your laboratories, and as well as that, serve the patients long term, and actually your insurance companies will save money as well. And although it's a different model, the concepts are the same, and I'll justify that later when I go through what's happening. But I think it will be useful to explain the changes which have been dramatic in the UK, just to give you a feel of what's happening. So we're going to look at the political landscape, because that has been a roller coaster, and it's political as in the changes and how the government is viewing pathology, and more importantly, how the government is viewing things like point-of-care testing. We're also going to look at the change in attitude towards private involvement, which has been huge. I've been working for the NHS for 40-odd years, and we were outsourced to Sonic in 2017. And what really surprised me, when I was working in the public sector, it was all about money. When I went to the private sector, it was all about quality, because reputational harm was way more important. So, better reporting, better systems, and the money took care of itself because we focused on quality. And that's where you make the most expensive thing you can do in the laboratory is make an error. So if you make fewer errors, you have better reporting, you have better learning, you're actually more profitable, which I know thinks is strange. Also, I'm going to talk about the new ISO 15189 declaration. I'm one of the authors, so part of it's my fault. Then I'm going to talk about how AI is coming in and how we're going to be changing the landscape and the workforce. So many of the issues we have are global. We suffer from underinvestment in laboratory medicine, which I'm sure you all do. That's a universal constant. I've literally flown here from China. Exactly the same problems. It's about underinvestment, struggling to recruit. I was actually in China talking about 15189, but it really resonated with what I'm going to talk to you about here. It doesn't matter where you are, it's the same problems and hopefully some of the same solutions. We're going to talk about the workforce and skill shortages and how we've managed to innovate those and resolve a lot of our workforce issues just by thinking differently. There's not enough pathologists for anatomical pathology, so I'm going to describe over the last 10 years how we've changed the dynamic of the workforce. And I know for some it may seem heresy, but it actually has worked incredibly well. And also there's constant pressure to do more, better, be more focused on outcomes and do it for less. Sound familiar, yeah? It's fairly standard. So I'm going to do a quick translation from English into English for you. Pathology is clinical laboratory, medical laboratory. Histopathology is anatomical pathology, tissue pathology. Blood science laboratory, I think you call a fluid laboratory. And infection sciences and microbiology, I think you call fluid as well. I did check this with Robert, because we are two nations divided by the same language. So I just want to make sure you understand what I'm talking about. So let's look at the politics. We had Brexit. What a great idea that was. We have COVID lessons and quality. We have a get it right first time thing run by the Department of Health, which I'll explain what that is. We have NICE guidance. NICE is an interesting acronym because it's not necessarily nice. It's guidance, but let's be fair, it's not guidance, it's regulation. But the UK government hates telling anyone to do anything, so they call it guidance and recommendations, and by the way, you have to follow it. So I don't know why they're just not honest and say, nice, this is what you are doing, as opposed to, this is what you'd like to do, and if you don't, we'll be really angry. Professional body cooperation, and that's been massive in the change, and I'll explain what I mean by that. I'm going to talk about the devolved nations. So it's pretty much like you have your states, we have devolved nations. So we have devolved powers in health for England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. So we're all meant to do the same thing, but everyone can do something slightly differently. And also we're now inspected by the Quality Care Commission, which is the CQC. And what used to happen, if we were accredited to ISO 15189, they didn't care about pathology. Now we can have an unannounced visit who will turn up that morning and say, we're inspecting your entire service, and if we don't like it, we'll shut you down. Which is fine, it keeps you on your toes. And we've been through a visit in Sonic, and it went, we weren't expecting a visit, and suddenly our main laboratory in the centre of London, knock on the door, 8 o'clock in the morning, the inspectors were there. And actually I was really proud that we did really well out of it. But certainly there were some very, let's just say, nervous senior management team, because they wanted to talk to the senior managers, but the people they really wanted to talk to was our staff. And unfortunately, or fortunately, they actually knew what they were talking about. We assumed they'll come in and actually be oblivious to pathology so we could say anything. No, they had experts. So it's good. I don't mind that. So let's talk about Brexit. For those of you that don't know, in January 2020, we took the decision to leave the European Union. My own personal view, a suicide note. It's been challenging. So what does this mean? We've now got trade barriers. So what? Free movement of goods ceased. Many vendors had set up their operation to be based in Europe for economy, because they could move anywhere in Europe, so it'll go some essentials, so suppliers could just travel seamlessly to the UK, seamlessly to Germany, seamlessly to Italy, seamlessly to France. All of a sudden, it was no longer seamless. We then had to go through various, it's a bit like you sending work to Mexico. You know, you need to have lots of barriers in place. Things need to be checked. Things are quarantined. And this was really increased paperwork and made the European distribution centres more inaccessible to us. So we had to rethink our business model about how we keep supplies, where we store supplies. We now have a longer lead time. So if you wanted to use lean and just in time, well, what we had to use is low fat rather than lean and almost just in time, but with a bit of wiggle room. So that had a financial impact on us, because we needed to maintain service with increased barriers. The regulatory framework changed as well. They decided to create something called the UKCA mark, replacing the CE mark, because we're not having any of that European stuff. But the problem is, our market is very small compared to Europe, and it's intensely unattractive to a vendor to go through CE marking, which is your FDA clearance, and UKCA marking. They're just not going to bother. So we've been lobbying very hard through the professional bodies and trade organisations to get some sort of recognition still for CE marking. And CE marking's also made more complicated because you need to actually look at your CE mark, because there's also Chinese export, which uses CE, and it actually isn't CE marked at all. So we have to be very careful we haven't got something that we call CE marked that's actually a Chinese export, which isn't regulated at all. And we can tell because the C and the E are too close together, but they look identical. Also, we have the IVD, which is the same thing we've been talking about with the LDTs. And so there's going to be a change in the European directive for manufacture and regulation of medical devices. And we need to understand the impact on the UK, because what used to happen is we'd have a European-wide mark and we'll just do the same thing. We are now having conversations with ministers to say, actually, we need to continue that, because diagnostic companies are not going to bother getting a CA mark, which means potentially we can lose important assays from our repertoire. So it's been an interesting outcome from Brexit, but we're working through it. So just be careful what you wish for when you think, actually, we're better off without. And I hear talk about states wanting to see and everything. This is a very good example of why you shouldn't, from a laboratory point of view. It causes lots of chaos and lots of contingency planning. But again, it's their choice. Now, COVID. You may have heard of COVID. We had to respond with novel technology in a backdrop of uncertainty and risk to staff, the same as everyone else. We had to cope with lockdown impacting on families and staff, as well as staff sickness, transport and testing continuity plans. We had lots of start-up companies for COVID entering the market, which was probably the same in the States. We had some super labs set up very quickly with varying degrees of governance and success, and some made national headlines for the wrong reasons, because one thing we knew is that many undercover reporters infiltrated the laboratories for headlines. So there was one that made the headlines for snowball fights outside, lax safety practices. And it was quite interesting, I'm pretty sure, because we had a rapid COVID laboratory, but we'd also set up a testing, I might come to this later, but I tend to talk around things. We actually set one of our other laboratories up to be a training laboratory, so no one was allowed into our COVID lab until they'd gone through 2 months of training, so which meant we had to cover the COVID workload with our existing staff while we onboarded, and if they were more competent, they came through. So basically, no one came into our laboratory unless they were fully trained, competent and signed off, which wasn't the case everywhere. And I know we had some undercover reporters because we had a few staff that left very quickly. And it's amazing, if you actually train an undercover reporter and expect them to do work, they don't like it. And this is where we used our quality systems and our quality management to make sure that we had a very... Because the reputational damage to us as a company, if we were on the front page of the news, would have been massive. And some of the private companies with COVID labs still haven't recovered from the damage. So it's really important that, you know, we didn't know there would be undercover reporters until we started seeing front pages of the headlines. And we were very proud to say our laboratory actually was the only one that hit turnaround times every single time. So, unforeseen consequences. Public had access to lateral flow testing and self-collection of swabs using mobile collection centres. They're now comfortable for point of care for infectious diseases. So we're getting a load of pressure saying, well, actually, we can do a lot of testing and sampling ourselves. Because, you know, the taboo of actually your patients can't do this, COVID proved that they can do it adequately and, in fact, very well. So there's been this sea change of, you know, self-diagnosis and self-testing. The government spent billions on a test and trace app, which basically reported to you, you went online, you gave your COVID, you also got this signal saying if anyone near you, so I had it on my phone, and it warned you if someone was COVID positive near you. If you had a positive result, it told you what to do, when to follow up, when you were safe to go out. So it was really intricate, but and this was people getting results on their cell phones. Again, people got used to receiving their data and information on cell phones, which they'd never had before. So this is a massive change in how public view laboratory services. And we now need to respond because there's this expectation that why can't we have it for anything else? So we need to manage that. Community point of care and self-testing is now accepted and needs further leveraging. So the quality agenda became a political issue. Rapid growth of startups funded COVID laboratories, and it could either aid or hinder the COVID response. Then the government issued an edict that every new laboratory had to be accredited to ISO 15189 2012. So you couldn't just say, I'm now doing a laboratory. You had to go through the full accreditation. And that became very difficult when they had to get patient samples to prove their validation and verification. But they all accredited, but the knock-on impact to our UCAS, which is the accreditation people, is they had to deliver this due to intense political pressure, which impacted and is still impacting all of our inspections because they had to, they got so far behind on the normal inspections because they were doing all of these start-up COVID labs. But the reality from that is the government has realised that actually you can accredit point of care services. So now I'm on a working group where we are looking to say to, and point of care for those that don't know is now covered by the new ISO 15189. So where you've got like our big chemist chains or dentists doing point of care, we have now got a lot of pressure to say to them, you now need to have your quality management system in place because we see the importance of quality and the government gets quality. So now we're expecting anyone offering point of care to start looking towards accrediting to 15189, which of course will then put pressure back on the accreditation service. So that was an interesting one we weren't expecting. So the government has actually realised the danger of point of care done badly. Get It Right First Time is a national programme to improve the treatment and care of patients through in-depth review of services, benchmarking and presenting data-driven evidence. It covers all aspects of medicine, surgery, emergency medicine. Pathology is included in the medicine work stream. And it calls in guidance, including secondary care direct access to diagnostic tests for patients for, say, COPD, asthma or heart failure. So it's now actually saying, this is what you need to do, but also this is the assay you need to use. So this has been challenging for some of our manufacturers. Further consolidation of pathology is an objective of Get It Right First Time. So lots of small laboratories are gradually being subsumed, and we've been doing this for decades, and it's been very ineffective, but now there's a drive to merge laboratories together because we need that economy of scale. We need more constant and consistent pathology. And this is based on something called the Lord Carter Review from Pathology in 2016. And this is one of these documents that Lord Carter, which I was involved with, wrote a review, and his first recommendation was that he write another review. Sound familiar? But anyway, so Lord Carter has made massive changes to the landscape where small little pockets of small laboratories are now under threat because we actually need this economy of scale. And we looked at identifying good and suboptimal practices, and then look at best practice and try and move them towards it. Now there's a lot of political clout trying to move us to a more consolidated service. Many networks failed to consolidate, costing the taxpayer millions, but we have had some notable successes. Before I was outsourced to the private sector, I went through three such mergers. All of them fell apart at the last moment, all of them costing the Exchequer money. So this has now led to which I'll come on to, is the increased involvement in private sector, because actually we're not having any of that nonsense anymore. So we have NICE. NICE is the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. They produce evidence-based recommendations for health and social care sector. developed by independent committees, including professionals, lay members, and consultation by stakeholders. It's termed recommendations. It's not. It's an expectation you adhere to. So let's look at the use of enzymatic creatinine for acute kidney calculations. We have to do this and set alerts up if there's a change in the AKI. So if you're using a Jaffa creatinine, which is cheaper, for any jaundice patient, you can't produce an AKI. So now they're contacting our accreditation body and saying, because accreditation is meant to look at patient and patient risk, they're now asking laboratories to justify why they are not using the more expensive enzymatic creatinine, because we're not getting that clinical information we need. Also, they're approaching the manufacturers and saying, you've made enough money out of that, please offer them at the same price. So it isn't all on the laboratories. We use enhanced liver fibrosis tests for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And this goes on to something we're trying to do. I was involved in one of the early projects, so I don't know if you've heard of ELF testing, but what we do is we look at our population, especially from South Asia. So you've got the Indians and Pakistanis and Bangladeshis. They tend not to drink, but they have a very ghee-rich diet, which is really clarified butter. So then they're at very high risk for liver cirrhosis. But they don't view it because... Now, if we were just to turn around to them and say, actually, you've got a high risk of liver cirrhosis, please change your diet, what do people do? Yeah, whatever. But what we can now do is we can predict, while it's reversible, the fact that you will go on to develop cirrhosis. So we can measure with the enhanced liver fibrosis, and then we can describe what a liver biopsy is like, the risk of dying from liver biopsy, the risk of bleeding, and how painful a liver transplant is. And this is your score, by the way, but you can do something about it now. Funny enough, that really gets the message home. So we're now seeing a decrease in liver disease because that's expensive. Despite the fact, you know, it's difficult for the patient to go through, but we want the hepatologist to only see the patients they need to see, not everyone. We also don't want to do liver biopsies because they're painful, expensive, and we don't want to put people in hospital because that's expensive. So this is a trend we're beginning to see. And also, there are more examples which bring additional financial pressures on many departments but are linked to patient wellbeing. And again, we are putting pressures on vendors. So we have a recommendation for pro-NT-BNP. So we can't just use NT-BNP because the recommendation is we use that method. And if you're not using that method, well, why not? Oh, the manufacturer doesn't like it. Well, that's no longer suitable as an answer. Why are you using troponin T instead of high-sensitive troponin I? So this is where we're centrally driving quality to try and get better patient outcomes. There are three major professional bodies, the Royal College of Pathologists, the Institute of Biomedical Science, which I used to be a council member of, and the Association for Clinical Biochemistry and Medicine. Historically, the cooperation was tense, but this has disappeared because what we're trying to do is work to the common good. We recognise their staff shortages and technology changes, so we're now looking at reconfiguring our workforce. And some of this I know will be heresy for some, but it's been really good. So what we're trying to do is recognise that we struggle to recruit pathologists, so we need to do something about it. We now have scientists being trained under the instruction of pathologists with competent sign-off to do a lot of the small biopsies. And so when we're actually doing the cut-up, a lot of the routine stuff that's been medically agreed as safe to do is no longer done by pathologists. We want them to focus on the specialist stuff, use their skills, not spend ages chopping up an appendix. So this has been something that's taken years to do, and we've now gone through a very rigorous training program with clinical sign-off with very set conditions, but we're now moving the workforce. We're using a lot of risk-based reporting to clinical protocols between professional bodies, and we're looking at support the education and training of specialist scientists. We're looking to focus consultants on the more specialist work because we don't have enough of them. So by taking the burden of the least specialist work, as long as it's deemed medically safe by our consultants, we have found this has greatly improved the productivity of our very valuable anatomical pathology specialists. We have pressure on turnaround time, so obviously digital pathology is helping. We're looking at more automating reporting to try and reduce the pressure. We've got some very good AI now that can actually read blood films. So what we're trying to do is generally focus our staff on what they need to do, not what they used to do. And this has been quite a sea change. We also have health boards that look at how pathology is funded and what services they do, as I explained. And they're looking at consolidation still, but different mechanisms. Some prefer private sector, some prefer public sector, some prefer a hybrid model. And it's very similar, as I said, to your state system. But this does add complexity when we're looking at multi-nation guidance, because everyone wants their own say in what they want to do. And we just have to be sensitive with this. Then we have the CQC, and they're called the CQC in England. Scotland has the Care Inspectorate, as does Wales, and Northern Ireland has regulation and quality improvement. They inspect pathology. They just come in, they give no notice, they ask the right questions, and if they feel you're not safe, they will issue a report saying we don't like the lab, or if it's really bad, they'll shut you down. So it keeps us on our toes. I have no problem with that at all. Because if we're not safe, why are we in pathology? And as I say, we used to be accredited to 15189. That was good enough. It isn't anymore. And also, they have a memorandum of understanding with the Royal College of Pathologists to highlight any clinical concerns. And this could mean that a pathologist could face disciplinary action within the college. And also, we have blood transfusion, which is the MHRA, which is like the FDA. Again, this has been for decades. They will come in unannounced and they will shut the blood bank down if they're not happy. And that may mean that we have to shut ITU, shut the emergency room. So it really means that we have a very good focus on quality in all of our blood banks, because they can just turn up and that can be devastating. And if you have a bad MHRA report as a blood bank manager, don't expect to keep your job, because we pay you to make sure that you do. I've never been in a situation where this has been an issue, but I have no problem on this aggressive quality standards, because there is a patient at the end of it. And if we just make it less aggressive, well, what happens is people will just push the envelope. And you say, well, actually, I can make more money by not doing it. Well, actually, you're not going to make any money at all if you shut down. So we have increasing private sector involvement. Most of it's in England. And it doesn't mean that there are no private laboratories across the four nations. It's just a different model. So the models I'm going to talk about is the public-funded laboratory, the private sector provided outsourced to NHS, the joint ventures with the private sector, which is something quite new, and the pure private pathology linked to private sectors, say the Nuffield Group or something like that. The Harley Street is pure private, so they'll send work to Sonic, but they will charge a massive fee to their exclusive clientele. So we'll do, say, all the Premier League. So this is where we have to have our governance really strict. So Sonic, for example, has the contract with the Premier League on transfer deadline day. Every test that they test the players on comes to our laboratory. So not only have we got to be really quick, but we've got to be really discreet, because we cannot afford anyone to leak that actually player X that's now up for 100 million transfer has failed a drugs test or something. So, you know, if we look at traditional public sector funded labs, they're attached to NHS hospitals. They're beginning to form networks, often as a result of the threat of the private sector. But there's also a recognition that most NHS laboratories haven't been touched for 20 years. We've just taken one on, and I walked through it, and I just congratulated the staff on actually being able to work in where they were. And the first thing, believe it or not, we did was we replaced all the toilets, because staff were actively finding elsewhere in the building to go because they were in such disrepair. In fact, I went there on the first day and almost got locked in one. And the handle was like this piece of dirty string. And it was just nasty. And again, it's the underfunding that you've got when you're competing with other resources. And this is a new laboratory that I've got here from Leeds. So this shows that actually now they're beginning to invest because they don't want to be left behind. So it's been a good driver. Many hospitals have shut down and been degraded. We also have a reduced number of pathology departments. And we often have hub and spoke models, which is something that we are now doing rather than having specialities on all sites. And this is another way that we're resolving staffing shortages by actually pulling staff into a core. And some of it is economic, some of it staff reasons. One of the problems is the government had this brilliant idea called Agenda for Change, where it was going to give everyone who worked in the NHS grades 9 through to grade 1, and you fitted on there. Now, one of the problems is that it was meant to be equal pay for equal value, and the way it works is actually most laboratory staff got a massive pay rise. Because the factors they looked is, do you have a degree? Yes, well, that puts you on band 6 immediately. Yet we're a graduate profession. So all of a sudden, everyone got a big pay rise, which was great for us, but all of a sudden, our costs in staffing costs were really high in pathology. And also, it was locally agreed. So you would have different people doing the same job in different hospitals earning different money. And people talk, which was then causing staff to migrate to better paid jobs because they're unhappy. But the main thing is we had a significant pay increase, which sounds great, but actually became unaffordable. So sometimes we've used pure outsource to the private sector. They're publicly funded. And, of course, it's attractive to the NHS if they can't form a network because the consultant so-and-so doesn't want to get involved. OK, we'll just put it out to tender. What the private sector brings is an access to capital, which, and also it's specialising just in pathology. So we have Northwest University Hospital and all the secondary care GPs go in there, but that is now run on behalf of the hospital by TDL, which is a Sonic brand. But what it does do is it gives key performance indicators to the hospital to find the private laboratory. One thing when we take on a new laboratory, one of my ongoing tasks is explaining the concept of turnaround times. Because when you go into an NHS laboratory, I'll say, well, what's your turnaround time? An hour. How do you measure it? It's an hour. Then we measure it and it's 2.5 hours, 3 hours. So then we have to work with them to explain, actually, this is important. Because there's a patient in the emergency room waiting. We also have flexibility and appropriate staffing to increase automation. We have a realisation that market forces will influence staff movement if we cut the wages too much. So it has to be sensitive. And it's a business. It has its own support services. So we have our own human resources, our own information technology, and that really does help. And we also, the wider healthcare management, like private sector involvement, because all of a sudden they get data, they get turnaround times, they get someone to yell at if it isn't right, and someone to fine. And also they save money as well. So this has led to private-public joint ventures, which are business units formed between NHS and private companies. So you partner and you profit share. So I work for the HSL side, which is a link between Role 3, UCH, two massive teaching hospitals, and TDL. So any time we get new business and we've just taken on another 6 hospitals, they will receive some of that profit. So what we get is a mix of NHS governance and private sector commercial skills. And the reputation tends to be driven on good patient outcomes rather than just price. And one of the reasons is that if we're doing 86 million tests a year, we will get a much cheaper price with our vendors. So we can go in way cheaper than a laboratory doing 1,000 tests a year. And then we can offer savings. So this is what Scoop. We've got some smaller hospitals attached. We have 2 hospitals that are customers. which means that any profit from that contract goes to the Royal Free and to UCH, so they like it as well. But also those hospitals have come to us because they're getting their pathology much cheaper than they were. And it also, the unforeseen benefit is that we now have all of our Harley Street doctors want very specialist tests the NHS can't afford. Well, we've now got them, so we give them an NHS price. So all of a sudden, it's opened up lots and lots of new parameters. I remember having a GP tour the building and said to me, well, how many allergens do you offer? And I said, 416. He goes, but I'm only allowed 12. I said, well, that's because you're not one of our GPs. Otherwise, you'd have access to 416 if clinically appropriate. So we're seeing a lot of benefit to the public side of access to tests they couldn't afford previously. Because basically, our private clients who are travelling from all over the world to Harley Street want those tests and pay a premium for them. So this is our building. Now, you may notice this is very tall. An ideal laboratory is very long and very flat. Not in central London, it isn't. So we've gone for a lot of automation and staffing accordingly. We put through 26,000 samples a day through here. I was talking to a colleague that works at one of our big teaching hospitals that's still NHS. They do 4,000 samples a day, of which 1,000 go in the fridge because they're too busy. And we've done that by 3 o'clock in the morning. So we are looking at new technology. What you see here is a microbiology plate reader. What we don't want is our experienced staff going negative, negative, negative. That costs time, that costs money, and also they're going to make an error because actually it's quite repetitive work. So for all of our MRSA samples, there's 2 of these in Europe. We've got both of them. We shove them all on the analyzer and it reports all the negatives out automatically. So our turnaround time has gone from days to, once it's incubated, about 15 minutes. But what it has meant is that we've not had to recruit. When we increase and take on new work, we don't need more scientific staff. Technology does it for us. And because we have capital, we can go out and just buy them. We don't have to go through an expensive tendering process, ask competing with theatres or competing with the baby care unit trying to get funding. So, as you can see, it's a spacious, nice place to work because it's very. We've even got a team of in-house decorators because what we can't have is staff working in somewhere they can't be proud of, which is unfortunately a lot of the NHS laboratories. We also have a rapid response lab and a state-of-the-art anatomical pathology laboratory. I think we do something like 86,000 blocks a year through there. And as we've taken on more work, we just bring it into there because it's all fitted out with state-of-the-art equipment. And again, it's because we can afford to do that because we have the capital. What I don't want to do is shove another 100 staff in there. What we're going to do is use as much technology, and we have dedicated cut-up benches for consultants, dedicated cut-up benches for our scientists that are trained. So we can actually push the work through so we can get the interesting cases to our consultants, the routine stuff that they're happy for scientists to do, cleared much quicker. So we've got some unseen benefits. We took on parasitology, renal stones and mycology. Parasitology is an internationally famed unit and they didn't want to come with us. So all we wanted to do is, because they couldn't recruit, and it's an ageing workforce, but it was a brilliant unit. So we got them in to design their own unit, and what's happened is that they've retired. And had they been left with the NHS, that service would have died. But because they've come into a much bigger unit, the same with the renal stones and same with mycology, it's in our training system, and the next generation of parasitologists is trained, the next generation of mycologists is trained, and we've continued the service, whereas it would have just died and withered because it was a small service of fantastic, dedicated professionals all heading towards retirement. And they couldn't recruit because it was a small service of dedicated professionals in a horrible building with no career prospects. So they were not recruiting. And because they became part of a bigger thing, we could recruit them. And also, we looked at cross-discipline working, but then we realised that if we make it too broad, we'd just spend our time training staff moving around sections, so we've moved away from that. We also have pure private pathology, which are linked to places like the Nuffield Circle and Spire. And these treat patients outside the NHS model. They offer walk-in testing such as Randox outside the NHS model. And this is the only one that asks for direct patient payment. Everything else is covered by our tax. And I've had quite interesting conversations. What I pay in tax towards health a month is about a third of what your premium is, and I've got no excess. And people will argue turnaround times are better. Well, they're only better if you're insured. So none of us worry about insurance because it's in the general population tax, which means the next bit becomes even more relevant. So we've got the ISO standard, which is now looking at risk-based and patient welfare. So we're having to redesign our systems around the patient and patient outcomes, like compliance with NICE. We've also got AI coming into the GPs, where we've now got AI bots filing samples. Now, we had no vision of this. I just found out that this is happening. So there's lots of AI happening outside of the laboratory's control. So a lot's been on outreach. It's driven by NHS London without talking to pathology. And what they don't understand, that a normal result may be significant in some disease states, because you're expecting an abnormal result. So there is concerns there. We're now looking at more AI and anatomical pathology. There is some papers we're using looking to look at more large volumes of samples with algorithms. And again, it can be used for many things. So we're doing lots of validation and verification of AI at the moment because we want to free up scientists. And don't forget, a lot of our scientists had massive pay rises. Well, when they retire, because that was back from 2004, we may not need to replace them at all. So there's a significant opportunity to either recruit someone cheaper or not recruit at all just by using technology. And again, we need to make sure there's clinical utility there. We have lots of long-term plans for things like genomics. So we have a system offering whole genome sequencing, part of routine care. And what we're trying to do, and there's lots of examples of this, is we're now moving towards national screening programs. I'm 60, believe it or not. As soon as I hit 60, I was signed up to the bowel screening program. Because what we're now beginning to do is do system-wide screening programs, because we actually think if we know someone's at risk of a disease, when's it cheapest to treat them? At the start, isn't it? So we're doing lots of projects like this, where we're doing lots of tests, where we're actively looking. It's a win for pathology, because we've been asked to screen people, so we get paid, we get income, we get it in our budget. It's a win for the health service, because they're not treating as many sick patients, because we can predict earlier. So everyone wins, and it comes out of general taxation.
We have 5 minutes left.
Yeah, no problem. So we've now got the NHS Genomic Medicine Service, which outlines the full range of genomic tests. There's a test directory there. And again, what we're looking to do is keep reviewing to make sure we're offering patients who will clinically benefit from it. We've now got 8 innovation networks developed for the model for cutting-edge genomics, all centrally funded. And what we're trying to do is leverage industry expertise and resources for a broader genomics ecosystem. And we're looking towards rapid informing commissioning decisions as well. So most of our new work now is very much about prevention. We're trying to move away from treatment to prevention, as I said, with the ELF test. And this is a real sea change in how we're operating pathology. We have a newborn genomics problem where babies are born with rare genetic conditions. And we're looking to enhance with early intervention for the quality of life, because these can be quite difficult to diagnose. So we're doing lots of screening. And there's some groundbreaking research where we're looking to screen 100,000 newborn babies and understand how we can improve our ability to diagnose and treat genetic conditions. Again, all centrally funded. And there was an extensive collaboration with public patients and families with rare conditioning, policymakers, and different hospitals. And we're looking to develop this evidence base to know what best practice looks like. Again, it's not waiting for a child to show symptoms. Let's get in early. Let's predict. Let's get treatment started as early as we can. And this is a general theme in the NHS now. And it doesn't matter if you're a public provider, private provider, we're all involved. We've got the multi-cancer blood test program, looking at up to 1 million multi-cancer early detection blood tests. And this is starting from the Galleria trial. And we're involved in the pilot program. And this is 50 to 70-year-olds who are outwardly healthy. We're screening the lot, or 20%, to work out what you're at risk of. Again, we want to treat. So we're talking to insurance companies about don't disadvantage people. But this, again, is this drive towards preventative medicine, which we should be doing. So we have the clinical utilities part of this trial. And for us, we act as a staging post. So we just get the sample, we send it off. But there's an understanding that actually a sample coming to a pathology laboratory has a cost because you need to package it, you need to send it, you need to accession it. So actually they're funding our handling costs as well, even though we're not doing the testing, which is a breath of fresh air, because normally you're just asked to do more and more for less and less. But there's an understanding that actually if there's a pathology component, money has to go with it. And that's built into the funding model. We have our own training academy because we want to develop proficient and proficient biomedical science workforce for the future. We want to guide them to how we need, so we're investing heavily in the training academy. So we've now got earn while you learn things. So you get full-time job, 20% off the job training, attending lectures, seminars. You earn a salary. You get your degree paid for. You have a four-year fixed-term contract. You develop skills. You get a BSc honours. You get registered. And you attend the training academy. So rather than saying, well, actually, I don't like the students coming out of university, they're not good enough, well, actually, we're now controlling that, which we can do.
We got two questions in the survey.
Excellent.
So we've got 2 minutes left.
Last but one slide. This is where we are for Sonic, and it gives you an idea of the scope of laboratories, some big, some small, with very good logistics between them. We've even now worked with the aviation and shipping industry, so every box we have has a GPS locator linked to the patient information and a temperature monitor. So I can tell you the difference in temperature on the train. What we can't do is say what that means clinically. Watch out for some research papers on that. So thank you for your time. Hopefully that was of use. Questions?
Two questions. One, are all of the lab services in NHS operated and managed by Sonic?
No.
Okay. Second question, has the UK standardized to specific tests, i.e. troponin, proBNP, across all NHS facilities?
So this is nice guidance. Some are resistant. So one of my jobs with my BIVDA hat on is meeting. So we've got two ways. We can ask labs nicely, or we can say to the accreditors, because the new standard is about patient outcomes, and say, do you know what? This laboratory here isn't abiding by nice guidance. Do you want to ask them on your next assessment why they're not doing it? And if they can't give you a good answer, they get a critical non-conformance and lose their accreditation. They'll learn. Because it's nice guidance. It's what we should be doing. And quite often you'll get the laboratory, I can't afford to do that. Well, have you spoken to your vendor and worked out how you can do it? Because we need to have, for certain conditions, certain tests, certain methods, because they're evidence-based. So we're almost there now with most of it. Of course you can.
I wanted to ask a question related to NICE guidance, because I remember a few years ago NICE put out a guidance that said good therapy for AML patients meant they had to have specific tests within 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Why you're not consistent with the guidelines when
Yeah. So it's for them to take a risk-based approach and communicate with, say, UCAS. Or there's lots of roadshows from the NICE team where you can feed back to them. But actually saying, I can't staff it, is not really something that people accept. Because one of the reasons they can't staff it, because in a small little laboratory, they've ignored the 20 years of instructions to merge to bigger, more robust units, and then complain that actually they can't deliver a quality service. Which is where companies such as Synlab, such as Sonic benefit, because the hospital management soon get tired of that. And if they can't run it effectively, they will come to one of the big companies, because we've got the resources, we've got the structure, we've got, and also they can come after us with fines if we don't comply with NICE guidance. So this is why we're seeing this changing model, because we have too many small laboratories that can't offer the quality that we need them to offer, because there just isn't enough staff. Yes. So we did have an NHS spine, which was meant to have everyone's record. And in true NHS fashion, they changed the spec every 30 minutes when a new bit of technology came out, so it never worked. So what we have to do, and it's part of our accreditation and part of our service, is that we integrate to the hospital's own laboratory information system. So any result we have either feeds to the hospital or the general practitioner, and we'll do reports, for example, if we get poor data. So that will go out, and we will give them real-time Tableau reports. But we need to make sure that our results are accessible to the clinician where they need them. And that falls on us as a laboratory. So it's, you know, it's no point us producing a result if we can't get it electronically somewhere. Okay, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate I am between you and happy hour, so I do appreciate you staying. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.